filthy, busted, overflowing, partially melted trash cans. There may be more iconic Toronto imagery, but our terrible trash cans are certainly ubiquitous. There are currently 11,000 of them throughout the city. It all began in 2007, when the city signed a deal with the media company Astral, who were meant to supply and maintain these bins, along with other street furniture like bus shelters. This contract is still in effect, and will be for a few more years. But the bins themselves didn't work very well. Their overcomplicated foot pedal mechanism was prone to breaking, the tiny openings would become easily blocked. It's common to see trash stacked on top of the cans instead of in them, in a kind of, hey, I tried my best kind of way. And Astral has never seemed to be proactive about repairing or replacing them, which they are supposedly required to do under the terms of that contract with the city. This week, Mayor Chow unveiled some new-look bins. 1,000 of them will be installed throughout the year. They're better, stronger, faster? There's going to be a pilot project on 250 of the bins using sensor technology to tell staff when the bins are full and to, quote, define trends and recommendations for optimal collection frequency. The sensors will tell us when to take out the trash. This is the season when most of the park washrooms are opening, some of the water fountains will flow once again, when we're going to put our bulky winter coats in storage and spend our days outside. A little beautification will go a long way as we try to make the most of our summer months. But there's a lesson, I think, in our old, terrible trash bins that we shouldn't forget once the nice new ones are installed all over town. Nothing is free in Toronto. Years ago, city councillors couldn't believe their luck. The city needed garbage cans, and here was a private company who was going to supply them and maintain them for free. It was almost too good to be true. It was too good to be true. The Astral deal will draw to a close, and we will have to decide if we want to lock into another. I think we should look back on our busted bins and remember there's really no way of shirking our civic duty. If we want nice things, we have to provide and maintain them ourselves. Hey, we're worth it. As for the kinds of contracts we signed with Astral so many years ago, the kinds where we think we're somehow going to dupe a private company into giving us something for nothing, well, we should throw them in the bin. This is Spacing Radio. Broadcasting from my own personal trash heap, I'm Glenn Bowerman, and you're listening to the official podcast of Spacing Magazine. Coming up on the show, we have a new issue of the magazine out called What a Mess! All about, yes, garbage cans and other street furniture. I spoke to Toronto Public Space Committee organizer Kara Chelu for this issue, but we're giving you the whole conversation here as a preview. But first, the Spacing website just published a multi-part investigation into the ransomware attack on the Toronto Public Library that hobbled the service last year. Contributors Sakina Syed and John Lawrence approached the disaster from multiple angles. I asked John what they uncovered and how we can protect the city's digital health going forward. Stand by. Late last year, I think a lot of people in Toronto will know that the Toronto Public Library was the target of a ransomware attack, a cyber hacking sort of thing that led to a 3+ month blackout, affected a lot of people. And you have undertaken to kind of get into the why, what that means and what needs to happen so that this doesn't happen again. First of all, just to put into perspective for people that are outside of Toronto or maybe even within who don't understand the impact, I read that the Toronto Public Library has the highest circulation in North America. So we're talking about tens of thousands of visits. Is it every day or?
Oh yeah, it's an incredibly successful library system in terms of its usage. It's for sure the largest municipal library system in North America. We have like 100 branches and 2 reference libraries. And they get, you know, they get an enormous amount of traffic, lots of borrowing, lots of people who go there to study and do research about different things. You know, there's a whole range of services. So as a civic institution, it's incredibly successful and important part of what knits Toronto together, which is why I wanted to really dig into what happened there, because, you know, most people don't pay that much attention to like cybersecurity stuff. It's sort of like a thing you know, you change your password, but it was hugely impactful. And so it was important to kind of unpack it a bit.
Right. And it really hobbled the service. I am one of those people that I know I should be aware, probably a lot more aware and more conscious, protecting my own security on the internet. You know, for people like me who are a little cybersecurity illiterate, this was specifically a ransomware attack. Can you tell us what a ransomware attack is?
Basically, what happens is your computer seizes up, or the computer system seizes up, goes to black, or, you know, just stops functioning. And then through some channel, the owner or the system operator gets a message saying, we're holding all your data hostage. And what that means is that they've impregnated the system with a virus that basically encrypts certain portions of the data. In this case, they encrypted a whole bunch of employee, you know, personal information, personal identifying information. And they say, okay, if you don't pay us X dollars, we're going to post it on the dark web and we're going to put it up for auction. And that's the business model, right? Like, ransomware is a business, and that's the business model. So you either get money through payments of ransom, which happens, or you get money by selling the data to whoever hangs around the dark web.
And so in this case, I believe the Toronto Public Library and the city, they did not pay this ransom. They kind of took the position of, we don't negotiate with terrorists, basically.
Yes, that's exactly true.
This person or group of people, I think I read in your piece, it was suggested that it was like a Russian group called Black Basta.
Yeah. So the way we know this is that there's a, you know, one of the gazillions of sites, news sites dedicated to all things computers called Bleeping Computer. And they posted a screen grab of the ransom note. And this is a well-respected website. This post went up a few days after the ransomware attack. This is before the city or the Toronto Public Library revealed that this is what was happening. And so when you start kind of going into what Black Basta is, it's a pretty well-known group. It's a derivative, it's a spin-off of an older gang. They seem to be based in Russia. I didn't contact them. I don't know anything more than what's available online through reputable sources. But there are a lot of gangs like that that have kind of, you know, sort of dotted line connections to state actors in places like North Korea and China and Russia.
And so in terms of, you said it was personnel, Toronto Public Library personnel information that was exposed through this attack. What level of exposure have they faced, and do they need to be worried, the employees of the service?
Well, it seems like it was not terribly actionable information. I mean, I think they got some numbers, you know, sort of addresses, the typical thing that would be in your personnel record. So from what the TPL has said, there was no financial information, right? So no banking records, no customer facing information, right? So this was all employee information. And it's important to say that it was current and past employee information. So people who had retired or left the library, going right back to amalgamation in 1998. So what the library did, and this is seems to be sort of normal course, is they hired a company that is actually in the business of credit. They do credit checks, this company. And so everybody who is affected has 2 years of free service with this company. If somehow it comes to your attention that your personal information was breached in some way, and that this is traceable to, you know, this attack, then you're protected. For example, if your SIN number was stolen and you can't access your SIN number for whatever reason, you're doing your taxes, then that's when you call in the services of this company and they help you sort it out.
Right. So, okay. I mean, I guess that's probably a relief for a lot of the actual staff members at the library service. Can you explain how that kind of evolved, though, into like massive shutdowns of programs, online and all the way up to the point of shelves not being stocked again, and everyone's books that they put on hold that they were hoping to, it really shut down the entire service.
Right. But my understanding, the way ransomware works, is that there's a breach and then there's a time delay, right? While the virus is in the system looking for the target of what it wants to steal. And part of that process is to shut down mirror sites, right? So, you know, most decently configured computer networks, they'll have the site with all the data, and then they'll have a mirror site, which has all the same data, but it's supposed to be separate as a backup. And, one of the sort of nefarious things that ransomware does is that you go in, you disable the mirror site, then you encrypt the original data. And so there's no backup. So repairing this is a fairly extensive process. So the TPL was very circumspect about what they did for, defensible reasons. But at a high level, what they had to do is basically take everything offline. And so they do a lot of things online, right? There's all the, there's the booking and circulation and the whole catalog, all of the databases that they make available to users either in the library or remotely. There's lots of stuff like that. And then there are all the internet facing terminals in the libraries themselves, plus the printing process, right? So you can send something from a terminal to a printer in the library. And all of that had to be taken offline, scrubbed. And my understanding is they were taken off site, a lot of these terminals, and cleaned, put in a sort of isolated place and then brought back, so everything that's going back into the system that's being connected back is clean. And that took a while because there are 5,000 computers in the TPL, which actually seems like a small number. I think that's probably 5,000 internet terminals or catalog terminals. And then there's all the backend stuff, people's laptops and that kind of thing. So it's a big organization, and there was a lot of tidying up to do.
Right. And as your co-author, Sakina, writes in the first part of this investigation, that affected everyone from families who take their kids, as a kind of daily or weekly little trip pick up a book, or, maybe there's after school programs, that kind of thing, all the way to academics who rely on this for their job. Or I was lucky not to be affected just timing-wise, but there's certainly been entire weeks where I've relied almost exclusively on like the digital archives to research pieces. Wasn't on deadline at that particular time span, but that could have really messed me up personally, and did mess a lot of people up, either for fun or for professional life.
Yeah. There's a point that the chief librarian made to me, and I'm going to repeat it here because it's an important point. The branches were open. Right? People could go in, they could borrow books. It was all done manually. What you couldn't do is you couldn't book a book online. Mm. And if it wasn't on the shelf where you expected it to be, you weren't going to find it because the catalog system was down. And, that interlibrary loan program, which is so important in the Toronto Public Library, where, your local branch doesn't have something, but you can book it and they can bring it in, that wasn't available. And at the back end of the borrowing process, the books that were coming back were not reshelved because that's also the process that requires the engagement of the computer system. You have to let the system know that, Huckleberry Finn is back at the Witchwood branch. So it was disruptive in that way.
Right.
And then, I found out about it because I regularly use those databases and mm-hmm. for my work. And I went to the website. It was like, well, what's going on here? I couldn't, you know what you do. You try to find a different way in. You do a bunch of different things. It's like not working. And then I realized that the whole thing was, there was news about this and it was down. So it affected a lot of people.
The service, it's not like they had no level of cybersecurity when this occurred. They did mention, you did speak to some people that said they had sort of trouble recruiting and retaining people with cybersecurity experience, but they were doing internal work to try and get up to speed with the kind of attacks that we now know are for certain out there and that we're vulnerable to. As well, you reported the Attorney General gave a warning in 2021 saying, hey, we're exposed here. You should really work on that. So how far along had they gotten at the time of this attack, and where do they now need to go?
When I did the research for this piece, I talked to some people at the library. I looked very closely at their public statements and their public reporting. And my conclusion is that they were not far enough along. That they had set in motion a process to kind of improve a whole bunch of systems, which basically dates back to 2020. But this one was not very far along. And this is the, when I say this one, I'm talking about modernizing and bringing the cybersecurity system to a point where it's robust enough to prevent this kind of thing from happening. And I think that what happened is that the Auditor General sent out a general warning to all of the city's departments and their agencies, boards, and commissions. And then the next year said, you guys have to get going. Mm-hmm. And she named five agencies, and the Toronto Public Library was one of them. The thing is that the other four were much more urgent, you know, TTC, police, right? These are the things that, you know, these are big complex systems that really affect the workings of the city. And, you know, there are a finite amount of resources. And my sense is from talking to people and from doing, you know, looking at the different progress reports, is that they should have been further ahead than they were. And they're still not as far ahead as they should be. And they sort of admit that. There's a whole kind of complicated ranking system as to how preparedness levels for cybersecurity in large organizations. They won't say exactly where they are, but they're not that much further ahead than they were before the ransomware attack. And it seems pretty clear from what they've said publicly that part of what was going on in this 3-month period was taking advantage of the fact that these systems were offline and being scrubbed and putting in some of those, you know, new features to make the system more robust than it was on October 27th, 2023. So all of which is a long-winded way of saying that I think that they had dropped the ball a little bit on this. You know, in the library's defense, the problem with cybersecurity is that they have a limited budget. Mm-hmm. They have a budget which is constantly under pressure from years of relentless budget cuts and budget pressures. This is what you get for that. And they have these competing needs, especially in the area of security, right? Because there are a lot of people who kind of go in and hang around the library, you know, who are, you know, they may be homeless, they may be have, you know, alcohol or addiction issues. And so security in the library is a big topic. And, you know, the library, to its credit, they don't throw people out just because of who they are, but they have to take steps to make sure that everybody can use the space at the same time. And that's a big budget pressure. And that's something very visible to people who use the library, where cybersecurity is not visible. It's not a thing that you can see. Its benefits are not something you could measure until you get something like this. And, you know, my sense is that there was some trading off that happened.
Yeah. And to that point, one of your sources said this is the kind of thing where you pay now or you pay later. You got to do a follow-up to the 5-part investigation where you actually found what the cost of this attack was. So it was $1 million, which the city agreed to pay for, not the public library service. It's not coming out of their budget. It's coming out of the office of the chief information security officer. And $1 million for people who follow city budgets is not, you know, it's not a big number. It's a drop in the bucket considering the amount of money we spend on other things. But you did mention $1 million is about 3% of the chief information security officer's budget, and that office's budget had also recently suffered some pretty significant budget cuts. So if we have this this teachable moment where we were warned, pay now or pay later. We were too late. We're paying now, but we're still cutting the kind of budgets that could prevent something similar from happening in the future. Is this a lesson we're just not going to learn?
So I think it was a teachable moment. I just want to say this about the number, the cost, right? Mm. So the budgeted cost for the remediation was $1 million. this is as of March 8th. The final bills have not yet been provided and not disclosed. I had to get that number out of Freedom of Information. So I suspect it's going to be higher.
Right.
And it doesn't include equipment replacement that had to happen, which is probably a big number. To my mind, the teachable moment is this. I think a lot of people in Toronto understand, especially when it comes to transit, the concept of state of good repair, right? You don't want to be on a train that's going to derail. You don't want to be in a situation like the Russell Hill collision in 1995, where, you know, two trains collided with each other. You don't want to be on that SRT that kind of derailed last year on this, you know. So this notion of taking care of the infrastructure is, you know, I think a part of our political discourse. It's accepted, and it's risen to the level of public dialogue, right? It's not just a thing that bureaucrats know. And I think this is what has to happen with cybersecurity. And the problem with cybersecurity is that a lot of people, they pay attention to it when their employer reminds them that they have to change their passwords. They don't really understand what's going on until, you know, like my father-in-law got a, you know, he was 92. He was on the receiving end of a ransomware attack, and someone's like, oh my God, everything has gone wrong. And you spend a week trying to figure out what's happened. So I think that the city needs to sort of do a little better job in communicating why this is such an important thing to invest in. And the way we know that is because we had this vital civic service that was offline for a quarter of the year. Systems are not completely back up still, right? Some of the printing is not available. And it costs a lot of money. You know, I mean, I'm not going to say $1 million isn't a lot of money. It's a lot of money, right? You know, so that's the cost of not paying attention closely enough to this particular part of civic infrastructure. Our infrastructure, we think about it, pipes and sewage systems and roads and bridges and transit rails and all of that stuff. Cybersecurity is part of that infrastructure, and we need to keep it up as up to date as possible.
It's intangible until something like this happens, and it's very tangible.
Right. It's like public health, right? You invest in public health, and the way you know that you've invested well is that people don't get sick. And the way you know that you've not invested well is that people get sick, right? So we learned that in 2020, and we can learn something from this as well.
Well, hopefully we invest in our digital health.
Yeah.
John, I want to thank you so much, as always, for taking the time to hop on the show.
Okay, thanks, Lynn.
And you can read that whole investigation, it's a good one, at spacing.ca. Now, Kara Chelyu is involved in just about everything to do with public space. She advocates for more spaces, more inviting spaces, and generally anything that lets people truly enjoy the public realm that is their right. With the Astral Media street furniture deal winding to a close, I asked her how we need to change our approach to public amenities. So what types of street furniture are currently found around Toronto?
Well, there's a whole variety of street furniture that we find around Toronto. Some of it is kind of common stuff that you see in cities across Canada and around the world, traditional benches. You'll find transit shelters, broken down garbage cans. Also, some attempts at wayfinding, including info boards that function more as advertising platforms. So we have like a whole mishmash of street furniture, which the city had tried to coordinate back, I guess, about a decade ago with its coordinated street furniture program.
Right. Talking about that program, it's the 2007 deal with Astral Media. Happened under the David Miller mayoralty, so a long time ago now. You mentioned, garbage cans, that kind of thing. But let me ask you, what is the state of Toronto street furniture under the 2007 Astral Media deal?
Yeah, well, you can really see a divide with the street furniture that we have. Certainly, the stuff provided under that Astral Media contract It is very poorly maintained, poorly constructed. The materials themselves aren't very durable. The garbage can is a classic example of it not functioning as it should. They're smaller than needed. Their plastic exterior is often broken into. It's not functional. It looks terrible. And it really gives the impression that the city doesn't care, which is, you know, I like to think that the city does.
For people outside of Toronto, can you describe these garbage cans? Because they have been a sticking point for people all over the city and even mentioned by previous mayors as a problem that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, well, the TPSC actually, there was a prototype before these bins were put out, and they were called like monster garbage bins or mega bins. So the bins that we have now are a bit of an improvement from that. These monster bins prior were basically just constructed to be big advertising containers. So the bins that we have now, they don't have any advertisements, but they're fairly small. They have a recycling and a litter spot, but the flaps for the open, it's often broken. It just, I don't know how to describe it. they're just really, they looked nice when they were first put out. They probably looked good on paper, but I don't think that they were actually used or tested in any sort of serious way. I've seen them start to break down literally years, they shouldn't have been broken down so quickly. And just like the lack of replacement of them is just really boggles the mind that we can have street amenities that are just in such disrepair in what we consider like a world-class or global city.
So with this deal with Astro Media expiring, you have a proposal to replace the current deal now that we can kind of start fresh. What is your proposal for the future of street furniture in Toronto?
I realize that the City of Toronto entered this contract in order to try to save taxpayers' money. In entering this private-public partnership to have the private sector deliver a public amenity, you know, we can see that what has happened with that is that private interests have kind of won out over actually providing the public good. The biggest example of that, it would be like the bus shelters, which are supposed to be well lit for safety and have good sight lines, but often the advertisements and now like the video, the very bright video advertisements detract from that and actually make it less sight lines. The lighting is for the advertisement, not for the space itself. So when we enter into these, when we expect the private sector to deliver public goods, you know, often these private interests went out, which is basically, it's an advertising company, so its primary interest is to advertise. What the TPSC is putting forward is to publicly provide street furniture and to publicly manage it. So that means often what we see in our parks is what we want, basically, for the entire city. So the Parks and Rec Department in the City of Toronto is responsible for the benches and the picnic tables and public washrooms in the parks. And so we're just calling for the city to provide that same level of service for the entire city to make sure that everyone has benches to sit on when they need. We definitely have related, but a bit separate, a call for the city to create a really robust network of public washrooms and to have a plan for creating new public washrooms whenever we create new public spaces, for instance. And so basically, we're calling on the city to take responsibility over the amenities that we need and to take care of them. And to, with that kind of ownership and management, then we'll be able to take care of our public goods in a way that they deserve.
Now, obviously, the budget is tight. The city council will be debating that very shortly. Would you be open to using advertising in some kind of way for this new furniture if it was kind of owned and maintained by the city as a possible revenue stream?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. Myself and the Public Space Committee, we take the position that public space is a public good that we should all benefit from. In the case of having advertisements in public space, you know, it's conveying messages of consumption, endless consumption, something that is not compatible with our limited world. We're seeing effects of climate change, environmental destruction, effects of unrestricted capitalism. And so basically, I believe that advertisements, you know, unless it's related directly to a product being like sold in the store itself, you know, they have no place in our cities in the form of billboards on our buildings or on our public amenities. Basically, you know, like you can't turn off the advertisements. You can't close a magazine and kind of avoid it. Like it's an infringement on our kind of right to be in public space without having these constant consumer messages bombarding us. So besides that point, also, if we do enter in some sort of agreement for advertising, there still will be some sort of negotiation and compromise to make sure that the amenities are designed to show the advertisement. And so having the design made for advertising rather than for human comfort and for human use will just most likely make the design not as appropriate.
So it sounds like your position is that this is a public good worth paying for, not trying to find some way that it can sort of pay for itself.
Absolutely. Well, I argue that public amenities are essential for allowing us to navigate the city and to access the benefits of urban life without having places to sit. People who are older, people who have disabilities, their mobility through the city is very limited. Without having public washrooms that everyone can use, we're more limited in how we can use the space, and we have to think about where we go and what we can access. Basically, public amenities are essential for making public space comfortable and used for urban life. And as we have seen over the pandemic, public space is incredibly essential. It became well used. It became, you know, it was shown to be very flexible, to be able to accommodate multiple purposes. And the only way to increase that flexibility, to increase that use, to make it more multifunctional, multi-purpose, is to increase the amenities that we have to make these spaces supportive for human comfort and just for human well-being and activities.
Recently, the city has removed a couple of bus shelters in the name of public safety, and I'm saying that in air quotes, with the argument being that people were using them to sleep in or as consumption sites for drugs. And so they just straight up remove them. To your mind, what role should street furniture provide during this kind of intense housing crisis?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, the removal of the bus shelter is a good example of what I call defensive urbanism. And it's a design and spatial management strategy that uses the built environment to guide or restrict behavior. And it's often used to protect investment in public space and also to remove so-called undesired uses of urban space. So the removal of the bus shelter was done because people in the neighborhood, the community, I guess there have been complaints about people using it in undesired ways. So sleeping, maybe consuming substances. Yeah, you know. No one, it's not ideal. The people who are sleeping in the bus shelter, that's not the ideal place to sleep. People who are unhoused need homes. You know, the situation just shows how there is an extreme lack of pairing supports and services to the people that need them. People who need homes are not getting them. People who need shelter are not being able to get what they need. And so they're using public space to survive. And in order to survive, you need shelter. You need to, you know, use what you have, which are those bus shelters. People who are you know, have addiction issues, they need to consume somewhere. If we're not providing safe consumption sites, then it's going to be happening in those public spaces. People who have no private space of their own only can do everything that they need to do to survive in public. And so we need to realize that what we're seeing is just a total lack of care and support for people who need it most.
Kara, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you.
That conversation is also in the latest Spacing magazine, which is in stores now, so go get a copy and enjoy. And that is the show. Thanks so much for listening. If you like this episode, please tell your local librarian, your sanitation worker, and the people that bag their dog's poo but leave the bag on the ground. Also ask them why they do that. If you have a moment, please share the show around, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, and help us reach new listeners. I make this podcast with Neil Hinchley, who composes our music, and you can find that music on SoundCloud at Track 82. That's all spelled out. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or tips, you can tweet at us at Spacing Radio, that's all one word, or email me at glennbowerman@spacing.ca. That's glynbowerman @spacing.ca. Visit our website at spacing.ca or visit our city store at 401 Richmond Street West in Toronto, where you can pick up the latest What a Mess issue of the magazine. In the meantime, seriously, why do they bag the poo and just leave it there? It's worse than doing nothing at all. Anyways, cheers.